Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we are now very pleased to be joined from Root Sports Northwest in Seattle. And of course, also the Too Many Men podcast. She is Allison Lucan. Allison, thank you as always for doing this today. How are you?
You know what? Hold on a second, guys. I was listening to some Paul Simon bangers. I've got to turn this down. Hold on. No, I'm good. How are you guys?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that the great Paul Simon debate has spread internationally. It's crossed the border south to Washington State. But, I mean, look, like, he had some great solo. He did some great work solo is all I'm saying, Allison.
Listen, I love him. I saw him live multiple times when he toured with Graceland. I think he is an elite artist, and he should get his due.
That is absolutely fantastic. I'm glad that you are on the Paul Simon side of the debate here. All right. We've had so much Paul Simon talk, though, already on this station. So we do have to move. We are, like, just peak levels of off-season discourse here on Sportsnet 650. Down in Seattle, big news, of course, new head coach Dan Bylsma joining the Kraken, replacing Dave Haxtell. What is your reaction, and what do you kind of expect to see with Dan Bylsma in charge of the Kraken now?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people were looking at Dan as one of the leading candidates, and I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about what he can do at the NHL level. You know, this is a coach who's been with the organization all 3 years at the AHL level, even when they were playing that combined split team with Florida the first year over in Carolina. So he knows the organization. He knows the people involved. He knows the facilities. He knows what the systems have been. And he's helped develop a lot of the key young players that are going to be counted on to be part of building this team into a contender. And I think that relationship bundled with experience and some experience at the NHL level, obviously a cup in Pittsburgh, can allow him to kind of move across a roster that's a lot of different age groups. And I was really kind of impressed, actually, when he spoke with us on Tuesday, above the X's and O's on what people may think they know of this guy. You know, it sounds like he actually went through some soul searching after his time in Buffalo. And it sounds like this was a very intentional choice to come back to coaching, but maybe not even with sights set on the NHL level. And I think he's done a lot of work to improve his coaching style. And I think he's really excited and grateful for the opportunity. So it's going to be interesting to see what he can do. A big focus will be adding offense, obviously.
Yeah, and his last 2 years in the Coachella Valley, right? Like, incredible records put up, deep playoff runs in both years. I believe they're still in the Calder Cup playoffs right now. And as you mentioned, you know, that learning process, what's your sense of exactly what he did, what he has, the transformation he has gone through, and how he's adjusted his approach since that stop in Buffalo?
Yeah, for sure. You know, he talked about that when he played, you know, coaching was very much a coach dictates and players execute, and there was no conversation. And he went into some detail about how what's very important and what he's learned to appreciate is that you have to have a relationship with each of your players. And then when it comes to executing a game plan or helping a player improve, that's a conversation. And it's one that he believes players really want to be involved in and participate in as well. And it's funny to hear him. Well, not funny. It's very interesting to hear him really crystallize it with his words, because I remember seeing him behind the bench during one of the first camps where he was present, and he was just bringing a joy to his job. You know, he was really leaning in, coaching guys on the bench, encouraging fun, encouraging smiles. And it was fun. I saw him up in LA or down in LA towards the end of the season. He came up when a lot of the younger players were called up to play with the Kraken, and the game didn't go so well on the ice. But after that, all the players who'd been primarily in Coachella this season, even Joey Decord, who played there last year, came out of the locker room, hovered around Dan, really wanted to talk to him, hear from him. So he's really been excellent at cultivating those relationships and then using that to propel his players to get better and be able to be at their best.
What you just described, Allison, seems like just about as significant a 180-degree difference from Dave Haxtell's style as possible. And by the way, I'm not saying this to criticize Hextall, who I thought did an excellent job across his 3 years in Seattle. But different approaches, right? It does feel like a night and day departure from what was there before. Do you think that's part of the thinking? Is that intentional?
Yeah, you know, I totally can see how it looks that way. And, you know, Dave was definitely a little bit more reserved. But something that always stuck with me, and we actually talked to players about this towards the end of last season, year two, and even going into the season before anything happened. And this is a guy, in Dave Hextall, who would keep his door open. And, you know, the more I'm around this league, I find that that's what today's player really wants. They may not like what you have to say, but they want to be able to have you say it to their face and have them be able to react to that back to you when you're delivering that message. And I think that maybe it wasn't as public, but I think that Hextall did really put the work in to have those relationships with his guys. I think, you know, again, Dan is going to bring in more direct relationships with some of these younger players. Hextall developed those only when those guys were up here. I just think Hextall maybe went about it differently and obviously, again, just a little bit more quietly.
With the success of Coachella, again, a second consecutive deep playoff run, I mean, who have been the standout players? Because last year, I mean, Decord, obviously we saw what he did in Seattle, but like I had high hopes for like Ty Cartier, Ryker Evans, the sort of promise of the run to the Calder Cup final last year. Only sort of partially delivered at the NHL level. Is it different this time around?
Yeah. So, you know, again, I think at the AHL level, we're looking at obviously Shane Wright, who's been out with an injury in the last round. Mm. But you're looking at Shane Wright, but you're also looking at players like the free agent Logan Morrison, who was signed last offseason and has been a really bright spot. He had a couple stints up here in Seattle and I thought showed some promise. Ryan Winterton is another player who I think can be a really nice fit at the NHL level in a bottom nine role, probably. And if you look specifically at the AHL club, and this is a bit of a different scenario, but, you know, Chris Drieger goes down there when Joey Decord seizes the NHL role this year. And Chris Drieger, especially last night, was a big part of that team eking out their first win in the conference final. So there's been some different standouts this year down there for them, and they're calling up a bunch of the younger guys from juniors who are at least practicing with the team and getting that taste of what's going to be required at the next level. But those are some of the names that in terms of the skater side that I think might be in the conversation coming to shift up next season.
So Allison, looking at the conference, oh, Drance, you have another on the Kraken?
No, go ahead,
okay.
Go ahead.
Sorry, looking at the conference
all
finals
you, baby.
Right now, and we saw the Oilers battled back to tie that series 2-2. And really, I mean, one of the, like, I can't believe I'm saying this almost, but one of the big storylines for the Oilers' playoff run right now is their penalty kill. And I mean, we saw it firsthand watching the series against the Canucks. They were just all over them, relentless. The Canucks could barely enter the zone with control. Last night, they score a big shorthanded goal that's the eventual game winner in that one. You know, a real key point of the game where Dallas has a chance to get back some momentum and potentially take the lead. And instead, it goes the other way. And you know, they're at 93.2% for the playoffs, which is an incredible number. Like, what has made this such an effective and imposing weapon for the Oilers so far in the playoffs?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You can talk about the penalty kill, but it feels like the whole story of Edmonton right now is that success is coming from all the places we didn't expect it, right? Like, you know, except for some blips, you're seeing Stuart Skinner kind of right himself last night as well. But I think that might actually be the key to this, is that this team is building off confidence from other areas of their game and finding ways to step up. I think Dallas, you know, a little bit, and you saw it in it, especially the first goal last night, they were trying to create their own speed. And I think Edmonton has found a way to counter that, both at even strength and when they're even down a skater. But what's impressive to me is Edmonton's ability. I can't yet decide if confidence is feeding momentum or momentum is feeding confidence for them. But when we're talking about what's working for them right now, we're talking about things that we don't usually talk about with the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, even like if you were to say, hey, special teams is driving the Oilers' success, we'd all assume you're talking about the power play. And the power play, I mean, was lights out against LA, scored a bunch of goals against the Canucks, but did start to slow down towards the end of that series. It's kind of remarkable that it has been such a factor for Edmonton. And, you know, just in terms of, like, I know you've been a big advocate of kind of the power kill, right, across the NHL, mm-hmm. looking for offense on the penalty kill, potentially using your best players. Is Edmonton kind of showing a little blueprint? Not that it has necessarily been their top guys, right? It's more of their depth players doing it, but just for a way to kind of turn your penalty kill, whether it's just by stopping momentum, whatever the case is, into a weapon for you in the postseason.
Yeah, you know, I absolutely think so. And I think that's, you know, I love my power kill. I love my aggressive side on the shorthanded side of the game. But as with all parts of this game, you have to match your systems to your players right. and their strengths, right? So it doesn't even necessarily have to be fully aggressive. Maybe it's partially aggressive. And, you know, I've heard some people make this point already, but again, when you talk about this penalty kill success, you're not seeing Connor McDavid killing penalties, yep. right? So you have a successful penalty kill. We all know, particularly if you think a call is maybe not one that the team should have taken, how a successful kill can feed that momentum. We hear players talk all the time about, you know, that was an easy kill because we were extra motivated to do so. If you kill a penalty, so you take a chink out of Dallas's swagger, and then the next line over the bench has 97 or 97 and his buddy Leon, you know, you're setting up in terms of a double extra push of momentum for the Oilers. And it's curious. We don't know that it is truly mathematically relevant, but the Oilers have been the best team at scoring a quick response goal after another goal happens on the ice, be it theirs or be it their opponent's. So there is something happening in terms of the Oilers' ability to harness momentum and take over the energy of the game that is actually pretty impressive. And it's something that I'm really starting to dig into because it's interesting.
Do you have any theories for it? Do you think there's more going on there than Edmonton has the like highest offensive ceiling of the teams in the playoffs and also the worst goaltending? Like, is it more complicated than that, do you think, Allison?
No, you know, it is interesting. I'm some of the theories that are kind of crossing through my mind, I think we're starting to see that Chris Knobloch maybe was underestimated by a lot of people, myself included. He's mm-hmm. made some very bold choices going back to that Vancouver series in terms of who he had in net and even the changes he makes last night. I think his changes have all worked out for the lineup, and I think things like that can matter. We all hear about, you know, playing differently in front of the new guy in net, or maybe bringing in a player who hasn't played at all or hasn't played in a few games, and the burst of energy and momentum and just fight for your teammateness that can come with that. I think there is some strategy involved, like the penalty kill feeding to getting your top tier talent out fresh and ready to go with some extra push in their game. And then I do think there's something about this team. If we're talking about how success is coming from areas we don't expect, this is a group that's been under the pressure cooker for how many years now? And if they can see the rising tide coming from areas they didn't expect, maybe that's just a little bit extra degree of looseness that they can play with and then a little bit extra boost of confidence that they can play with that they just push to come right back and say, we're going to restake claim to this game.
It was pretty stunning how all of their bold, controversial second-guess decisions kind of played out. I mean, everything from Corey Perry picking up an assist to McLeod in the top six scoring. I mean, you couldn't have scripted it better, right down to, you know, two consecutive dashes right off the hop for Darnell Nurse. An issue has Nurse and Edmonton's defensive depth been? Like Nurse CC as a pair, Nurse generally for the Oilers over the course of this playoffs, in your estimation?
Yeah, you know, for me, honestly, I've said this a couple other places, for me, the issue is Nurse CC, right? You know, and I think even on, I think it was the second goal last night where, you know, Nurse has turned around and I'm like, oh, of course, if he's out there. But, you know, honestly, I would have liked to see Skinner seal up the post there. So I don't put that on Nurse. I think that was maybe a right. little bit more flaw of what was happening in net. And, you know, there's been some other folks who've written about this. I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but it's the CC pairing that's been the biggest concern for me. And I think to see Nurse come out and do what he did last night is a way to kind of start to grapple back and say, it's not me. It's maybe the situation and the deployment in terms of my pairing mate that have been part of the problem. And I think the other problem is the price tag, right? Like, if this is a cheaper defender, we're not necessarily slinging these arrows, but while the defense has been good enough to get them where they are, this was the area we were talking about at the beginning of the season too. So it's just going to have to be a relative area of weakness for this team that they continue to try to cover for if they're going to win, you know, six more games and try and get a cup.
Over to the Eastern Conference side of things, Allison, and you know, the shot metrics in the first two games of that series were, I think, probably a lot closer than people would have expected. In the last two games, Florida has really, really started to tilt the ice, which is not necessarily a big surprise. Like, that's something the Panthers can do at a high level. What do the Rangers have to do to kind of stop that flow a little bit and find a way to? I mean, it's still a 2-2 series, right? But find a way to even up the run of play a little bit in that series.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think there's been some changes there. I think there's been some question marks about Adam Fox's full health, right? And of course, you know, he can be a big part of contributing to moving play north and then contributing to an offensive push. But yes, I think that the Rangers have to start to assert control and start to break through that neutral zone and not necessarily not go full Trouba on us. We don't need any more elbows flying around out there, but to allow the physicality of their game to come to fruition too, because Shesterkin has been great, but you can't continue to rely on him to be the sole answer if you're going to get through to the final.
I also wanted to ask you about one player in particular on Florida. You know, we talked about Sasha Barkov as the most underrated player until it became a punchline, right? Like, he can't be the most underrated if everyone continues to talk about it. But I'm looking at Gustav Forsling now. He's played the most 5-on-5 minutes for the Panthers in this series. They've outshot Florida or the Rangers 45-23 in that time. He's been like right at 40 points for each of the last 3 years in the regular season. I know he just signed that big deal. Does he have a case to be made for most underrated player in the NHL right now? I mean, we're a little bit familiar with him here just because he was originally a Vancouver draft pick, but I feel like he's somebody who's not necessarily on a lot of people's radar in terms of elite top of the lineup defenseman.
Yeah, no, I agree, you know, and I think it's above and beyond. You know, we see him get a game winner, you know, earlier in the playoffs. And John Tortorella always used to say is that your legacy is built in the playoffs. It's not built in the regular season. And aside from the fact that I still always want to say Forslund instead of Forsling when I'm talking about him, you know, I think this is a player who has really seized the opportunity. I'm liking what I'm seeing from him. I'm liking his contributions. I think this is our new cause that we should take on, is that this is the new most underrated Florida Panther in the league.
Yeah, it's apparently it always has to be a Florida Panther for some reason.
That's right, exactly.
Allison, really? Oh, no, go ahead. Oh, we lost Drance. Drance is trying to talk, but I think he's on mute. We got you there, Drance?
Yeah, sorry, my dog was barking, and then I forgot that I muted. No, I was saying it has to be a Sun Belt player. That's the rule. Mm. Remember, it was Louis Erickson before it was Sasha Barkov.
I feel like Rupe Hintz might have had a little time with the crown there.
Yeah.
Yeah, also a Dallas guy. So we'll see.
Yep.
I think it's Gustav Forsling's time to run with it now. Allison, appreciate it as always. Thank you for doing this. We'll chat again soon.
Sounds great, guys. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. That is Allison Lucan.
You too.
From Root Sports Northwest and the Too Many Men podcast, weighing in on the Seattle Kraken coaching hire with Dan Bylsma, and also what she's seeing from the conference finals. Just quickly on the Kraken, I know you've been kind of perennially high on the Kraken, right? It was a bit of a running joke for us this year, right, that you refused to sell your Seattle Kraken stock. With the huge caveat that, right, the whole summer and all of player movement and the draft, et cetera, is still to come. Are you still kind of high on Seattle looking ahead to next season already?
No, probably not. I need to see. I mean, we'll see what they can accomplish. But I'm buying like Matty Beniers is going to bounce back. I'm not worried about that. I still am holding my Riker Evans stock in a major way. And I do think they needed a coaching change. So, you know, we'll see. I hated their summer, and I do think that they're unfortunately like they built in such a way where I just think they built straight for the mushy middle, where it's like, yeah, you can win a round and make game seven of the second round, but that's not really proof of concept. You know what I mean? Like, that's a nice season, but that's kind of all it is if you follow it up the next year and don't do anything. And they didn't do anything this year, right? I'm sure Canucks fans are listening to that, hearing a cautionary tone, but it's not about that. It's about whether or not you're able to sustain the sort of success that you had long enough that, you know, you can break through in the playoffs or have a shot to. You know, and the Canucks have top end talent that Seattle obviously doesn't, which is a huge challenge. So, yeah, I'm still in to an extent, but not hugely. Also, I am in the Coachella Valley right now. And game two is tomorrow.
Are you going?
Friends visiting, and I've got some friends visiting, namely Dimitri and his wife. And Dimitri's been like, "Do you think we should go to the game?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm going to pitch my wife on like, hey, we're on vacation after the season. Do you want to go to a hockey game?
You want to go to a minor league hockey game?"
Hey, how dare you? AHL hockey in the playoffs? Awesome.
I'm not saying it's not awesome, but it is definitionally minor league.
I mean,
that's just what it's not a pejorative. That's just what it's called.
It's like, I don't know. It's a hockey game, man. Like, what are you talking about?
It's not a value judgment.
It's pro hockey.
It's just factually correct.
It's high the quality level below
the
hockey.
The level below the highest level is called minor league. That's what it is. Again, I'm not saying it's a slander the AHL.
Yeah, I mean, do you want to go to a minor league game? Is not like something you say to someone who's considering going to like a Canadiens game or something. It's like, do you want to go to the Nat? We'll have a blast. The arena here is awesome.
So anyways, are you going?
Anyway,
have you convinced the wife?
I've been too scared to pitch it.
I hope she doesn't listen to the show. I'm sure she doesn't. I'm too scared to talk to my wife about this, so I'm gonna raise it on my radio show instead.
Well, it's a funny
try to soft launch the conversation with her.
Hey, it's good sports radio fodder. It's just like a conversation I'm not eager to have.
Well, I will say, I mean, like, to peel back the curtain a little bit, you and Dim were talking about this earlier in the week or last week or something, right? And I said, like, just tell the ladies to go out and get margaritas and meet you after the game. It seems like an easy solution to me. They don't have to go.
Honestly, that is a good take.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You and Dim go be bros at the hockey game and then meet up with them later.
Yeah, probably. That's probably the play. We'll figure it out.
All right. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now, somebody texted it in angry that, you know, we had the whole open segment last segment. We only read like two texts, but it's because they're just good texts. And we ended up having big discussions about them off the back of those texts. So, look, we do our best to get to as many as we can, but sometimes they just spark a lot of conversation. And we'll continue that conversation in the final segment of the show. Sportsnet 650's very own Satyar Shah.
Why are you being so nice? We don't owe you anything.
What do you mean, why am I being so nice? I'm a nice guy.
Tell that texter that we don't owe him anything.
You do it. You reply. You can
reply, man,
to text.
We don't owe you anything. You want us to read your texts on air? Text better stuff. The urologist. He always brings the heat.
I definitely have told people that in the inbox before. Like, listen, man. We get hundreds of texts. Yeah. Got to raise your game. Got to raise your game in there.
And we read, like, how many times do we read Chet from Burnaby or yep. Abu? Like, come on.
Austin and Langley.
You send us something good, we'll get into it.
Yeah, you got to get your game up, right? Be like,
on you, man.
Be like Mike the urologist from Brockville. On that note, 100%. We will go to break. Satyar Shah from Sportsnet 650 Canucks Central joins us next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It is Thomas Drantz here. Final segment of the show for today. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Now joining us, of course, from right here on Sportsnet 650 from Canucks Central. In fact, he is our guy, Satyar Shah. Sat, thank you, man, for doing this. What's going on?
What's happening, boys? You know, just another day in beautiful, sunny Vancouver. Thinking Canucks off-season topics. You know how it is.
Yeah, talking off-season Canucks, talking Simon and Garfunkel, talking, you know, whatever we can figure out to fill the time here going into the summer. So,
okay, so what's your favorite Simon and Garfunkel song? And don't say Sound of Silence. It can't be that.
Drance has said Sound of Silence repeatedly.
Well, you can't. Well, I mean, that's like the obvious one. Like, everybody's favorite, like, yeah, you know, song.
I would say, if we're talking Simon and Garfunkel, I'd probably say Mrs. Robinson.
All right.
What? Do you have like an obscure pull for us? You have a deep cut, yeah. Simon and Garfunkel set?
Yeah. I go with Homeward Bound.
All right.
Homeward Bound, Scarborough Fair. There's so many to choose from because they're better as a duo. It's amazing.
Exactly. I'm with you. I don't necessarily disagree with that.
All right. Wow. Finally. It took him a while. It took like 24 hours, but Drance has found somebody that agrees with him on his day.
Let's go. Sat, my guy.
Okay. On the Canucks, before we get carried away with the Simon and Garfunkel talk, Mike Yeo leaves the organization this week, and now, you know, we, as I said to Drance earlier, like, we were already wondering, are they going to hire a power play coach? Are they going to make an additional full-time coaching hire before Mike Yeo left? Now they're down to one full-time assistant. What are you hearing, and what do you kind of expect to see in terms of the Canucks filling out the coaching staff over the next, you know, months here into the summer?
Well, I would expect that they would add somebody, especially with Mike Yeo not being there. I think they would love to turn Gonchar into a full-time head coach. I'm not sure where that's at, whether he's able to do that or not. But I would guess that at this point, with Yeo not coming back, they are going to add somebody, especially if Gonchar is not going to go full-time. I just don't think it's going to be a power play specialist. Like, that's just not what I think it's going to be. Now, hey, maybe they'll switch it up on us, but considering everything they've said, they have the Sedins there they rely on, Talkin himself, Gonchar being in the fold. I feel like they think they have enough guys to figure out the power play internally. So the question is, what's the biggest need you have if you're hiring a coach? Is it the PK? Is it somebody that can kind of run your practices? So I'm really curious to see what area of expertise they're going to lean on more.
So on the power play, because you're right, at the media availabilities, it didn't sound like that was top of their list, right? Like, there was some reluctance, mm-hmm, it sounded like, to really go down that road, which is a little surprising given, I think, kind of, you know, how unusual or unorthodox it is for the head coach to also be in charge of power play one around the NHL. Is there going to be any tweak to kind of that approach, right? Or is it going to be the same kind of by committee? All right, Talkett does power play one, Sedins are there, Gonchar is there. Like, does the approach from a coaching perspective to the power play change at all, do you anticipate, going into next year?
I think it will to some degree. Like, I think one of the things that they're pretty honest about is we can do things differently. We can do things better. And you don't want to get caught in a situation where you get stubborn and say, well, let's keep doing the same way and we will eventually figure it out. I'm sure there will be some sort of tweaks to how they handle things. One of the things that I'm kind of wondering about as well is, do you have to completely revamp your overall approach to how you enter the zone into the power play? And when you start making tweaks in season, sometimes you make some tweaks. We can't overhaul everything you do. There isn't enough time for you to implement that in season if you want a new entry. So I wonder if they start doing something completely different in terms of how they want to set up their power play on entries, because they got stuck doing that more than anything else. Like, we all have issues with sometimes, to the coach's point, they get mechanic in their own zone. But I think their main issue, especially in the postseason, was being able to get through the neutral zone, getting set up in the first place. So I would guess that's going to be their main area of focus. How do we revamp our entries on the power play?
With where the Canucks are positioned and sort of the idea of targeting a significant top six upgrade, do you get the sense that this club is willing to spend a premium future to upgrade or try and chase a star over the course of the next few months? And what I mean by this is, like, I'm talking 2025 first, Lekaramäki, mm-hmm, Volander types, which all, you know, assets across the board they were not going to part with at the trade deadline. Does that balance shift a little bit if the right piece is available this summer?
Well, I certainly wouldn't put it past them, right? I think they're definitely open to those things. They would listen towards it. What I would guess that they're trying to do first is exhaust every other avenue to add a player like that without giving up those assets. And I think that is obviously the first one is, can you get somebody like that in free agency? If that even gets that far, like a Gensel type, if you're so lucky even. But if not, then you're probably looking at, okay, if we're keeping Hironic or not, maybe we shift him. And you heard the Nechas stuff about maybe he goes for Nechas if you're not signing Hironic. So that kind of adds a forward to your group, but then it leaves an issue of how do you improve your blue line if you're moving Hironic, obviously, right? But I think they would prefer to add that player via free agency or via a hockey trade if possible. But I think if they exhaust all those possibilities, you may have to consider those things. The only question I have is Nechas a player they feel like is the overall top solution where it's worth you trading away a Lekkerimäki, worth you trading away a Rolander in the future first round pick? And the only reason I would hesitate somewhat, I'd like Nechas a lot, for instance. But don't you kind of, if you're giving all that stuff up, don't you kind of want a lefty shot you can put in the bumper spot as well? Like, to me, I look at, if you're looking to make a big addition to your forward group, you need somebody that can play with Pettersson, obviously, but you also need somebody that can really take ownership of that bumper spot again, right? Because you need that play from JT to the bumper spot, and they've had that play hasn't really been there since they traded Bo, you know, last year. And I would love to see them add somebody that can do those things. So I just don't know if the player that they would be willing to move those assets for, if that player is available right now in the market or not. Because if you do Nechas, I'm sure he'll help your power play, but does he solve the main issue you have on your man advantage? And that's the thing that I'm kind of looking for, that if they're trading those assets, it's going to have to be the perfect high-end fit.
With just the overall sort of shape of this offseason, the reams of cap space, all the expiring players, you know, on and on down the list. If you were to prioritize one of Vancouver's expiring contracts, so RFA or UFA, you know, I've been pounding the table all week on these airwaves about Filip Hronek being the guy who I think is different in terms of quality, in terms of priority than everyone else. Would you have someone different, or do you have my back on that in addition to my Simon and Garfunkel takes?
Well, I would say based out of all those players, I think he's the guy I would most want to see come back. Because I don't know if I'd like paying Dakota Joshua north of $3 million for 4 years. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure I'm there. As much as I like Nikita Zadorov, I'm not sure I'm there on that either. Like, even on Hironek, I really shudder at the thought of paying him $8 million. But at seven, like, hey, maybe that can work out. Like, so I think in terms of quality for all those players, it is probably him. Like, I'm still high on Lindholm, but I just don't think it's realistic. If I have to keep one guy, it probably is Filip Hironek, because he's the guy who has the highest upside of all the players and has the best fit on the team, right? The only question is on him, like, if he's truly holding up for $8 million, like, I don't think it's happening here, guys. You know what I mean? So I think that's going to be the biggest question about it. But I don't disagree with you. I think the player that solved your problems the most on the back end is retaining Filip Hironek. Like, Zadorov's the guy that everybody's fallen in love with. But let's be real. If you have to pay him $5 million plus, like, how are you going to feel about that when he's playing 17, 18 minutes a game and you get the regular season of Zadorov where he's good, but then you get those games where he's like 4 out of 5, right? And I just don't know if Dakota Joshua can play up your lineup enough for you to feel good about an investment on a contract that's going to pay him $3.5-4 million per year potentially, right? So if I'm paying money on somebody, I think the guy you feel is safest is Filip Hronek.
Yeah, and as much as I've been kind of pushing back against Drantz, right, because I like the long-term deal for Hronek does make me very nervous, right? At the same time, as much as I would be open to exploring options to trade him, I also recognize, like, even beyond Hronek, let's say they keep Hronek, you still want to go out and add another impact defenseman, like, long-term, even if you don't do it this summer, but you still want that on your team. So I do understand that, like, okay, Filip Hronek's demanding $8 million, so you trade him. Well, that just makes, as much as I think that's the right move, I also understand the flip side of it, that it makes it, you know, then you have to find two impact defensemen at some point to complement Quinn Hughes if you're going to be a Stanley Cup contender.
No, for sure. And I think that's part of the issue. If you're trading Hironek, whether it's for another defenseman or another forward, all you're doing is shifting the decks a little bit. And that's a good thing sometimes, because you're balancing your team, right? You're finding ways to address needs and not having to, you know, substantially affect your budget in certain ways to make those moves. So I'm not against doing so. But you're right. If you're trading Filip Hironek, that means, so the way I've been looking at this Canucks team, talking to Reach about this too, it's like, we can look at Canucks having like six players we view as like core type of pieces, right? It's like Pettersson, Demko, Hughes, JT Miller, Brock Besser, and then Filip Hironek falls into that category as well as a higher end player. So we look at it and say, well, they have these six, like, bona fide top six, top four defensemen, top pairing defensemen type players. We want to extend that list to, what, seven or eight. So if you got six of those, you still need to add two more, right? So I'm with you on it. So it's like, the thing I like about if you're trading Hironic, though, if you don't sign him to the $8 million, it is the 1 year where the free agent market has a few guys available for you. Now, I'm not saying you go out and sign Pesce and Montour to like monster contracts or whatever, but there's about a dozen right-hand defensemen who can play top 4 minutes for you in this year's class. So I do think it is a unique year that if you do have to punt on Hironic, if you are able to get a top six winger, a legitimate guy to play with Pettersson in exchange for him, it might be easier this year to address your right-handed defenseman needs in the free agent market. Whereas in other years, it's usually the other way around where you can find lefties, you can't find righties. This year, it's easier to find righties and lefties on the free agent market. So there is a little bit of, there's a bit of an out here for the Canucks to address their right-handed needs to trade Hironic because it is a bit of a unique free agent market this year.
So talking about, looking for the big trade potentially, right? Like if you're not able to get a Guentzel, there's not a ton of other high-end forward options out there. Do you have to explore the trade market? And as we were talking about earlier in the show, okay, you look at the assets they have to deal next year's first, right? Karamäki, Vilander, and then really probably fourth on that list is Nils Höglander. And we were kind of talking about the merits of selling high versus continuing to bet on Nils Höglander. Do you see that as a possibility for the Canucks this year? And I mean, how much would that potentially move the needle in a package for a star winger out there?
So I think it's definitely a possibility. And I do think, though, that Höglander did impress him last year with the step he took, because in many ways it was also a validation of all the work they've been doing in Abbotsford, developing these players. So it wasn't just about, here's a guy we didn't draft that we believe in, though. It's the guy that they felt like they helped bring along. So there's a level of pride in that, too, and a level of, hey, look at what we're doing, validating all our work and developing and getting the most out of these players. So I do think that's real. But the biggest question I have about Höglander is he a top-kid player? And is he going to be a player who's going to play special teams on this squad with Rick Tocchet as head coach? Is he ever going to play more than 12, 13 minutes a game? If the answer to those things are no, you have to sell high on him. Like, you just have to this offseason, because I don't foresee a situation where it makes sense for you to extend a player who has a 24-goal season on his record, who's going to be making north of $3 million, if he's only going to play 6 minutes for you. Like, I don't find that to be a wise investment. I think you have to trade him if that's how you view the player long-term with this head coach. But I would be careful in assuming that Höglander in and of himself is going to have this major impact on the value of in this major draw to bring players in. I still think that you have to add a couple more pieces on top of it if you're looking to make a big addition. So I would be really careful in assuming that Höglander's trade value, as much as it's higher than it's ever been, is high enough for you to be able to, say, grab a Nechas. I think if you're looking at having Höglander as part of that deal, you'd need at least two more significant assets. So I think the thing with Höglander that complicates it is, what is his true value and what's the player can get back in return? Are we looking at a high-end player, or are you looking at another role player who might fit in better for you in exchange for Höglander? Whether that's somebody on the back end, whether that's a forward, that's my only question. His value is higher, but is it high enough for you to be able to pry a Nechas out of Carolina for him?
Yeah, I don't think so, right? It feels like the second piece in a deal that lands a player like that, right? I mean, it feels like... Yeah. It feels like around the league, given that he's, especially given those sort of, like, it's complicated because the 24 goals feels like it should be a major impetus to give him significant value. And yet I feel like the playoff performance, the inability to take that step, is something that will last in the minds of other teams. And it's certainly based on what the people that I'm chatting with. How do you sort of rate the idea that his value is at its peak given his goal totals versus, the possibility, given the work rate, given what we see on the walls, given what we see when he's carrying the puck through transition, that he might be able to hit another level as a two-way piece?
So my only question about him hitting another level is, who can he play off of and play Nate with, right? Like, is he going to score enough for you to play him with Pettersson long-term? And can he set up Pettersson enough for him to be a fit there long-term? That's my only question about it, right? And that's the thing about Höglander that I think others have some questions about as well. They feel like, is he truly a player that can be a catalyst playing with your star players, or is he better off kind of being the catalyst himself on his own line, on the third or fourth line. And if the question, if the answer is the latter, somebody who plays down your lineup as a catalyst, well, that shows you that the value is going to be somewhat mitigated, right? Because you're not looking at a player who's, again, a special teams guy, a diminutive forward. Teams aren't going to be forking over their best assets to acquire him, right? So I do think that's part of it. I will admit, like, I've always kind of been a bit more skeptical the past couple of years about where Hoglander's gone. I like the step he took this year, and I think he did a terrific job in advancing himself and perhaps showing he has another level to it. I just don't know if I see enough playmaking ability in him and his finishing to be good enough to truly stick long-term playing alongside of Elias Pettersson. So I'm very much on the side of, even if you're not getting the maximum value, do something while you can before you get caught in those situations where either you don't want to qualify him because now he has an ARP case, his RFA numbers are too high, or you feel like you got to pay this guy a bit more. And next thing you know, you're paying him $3.5 million, and he's playing 12 minutes for you on your third or fourth line the rest of the next 2 or 3 years. Like, that's the thing I want to avoid with Nils Höglander, because I just don't believe he's a top six player in the NHL.
With Lindholm in particular, that one to me feels like the biggest buyer beware that the Canucks are staring down the barrel of entering this offseason. Where are you at with how the club should, in your view, approach things with Lindholm?
So, I mean, I was on the line along the lines of, if you get Lindholm for like 5x5 or something, sure. You know, like, I can live with that. Play up and down your lineup potentially, right? Like, he's a guy who can play 20 minutes a game. I just don't see the fit here long term if you're paying him north of $7 million or something. And that's what he's going to get on the free agent market, especially when you have such a big need staring you in your face for Elias Pettersson's winger long term, right? Like, I don't know how you're able to address that need the next year or two if you're signing Lindholm to a longer term contract. And I know the team loves Lindholm and they want to keep him. I just don't know how realistic it is, especially if he's able to get north of $7 million. So I like Lindholm if you can pay him five or so, but that's not realistic. There's no way he's signing for that type of money. And it just comes back to me too. If you're signing him into his 30s on a big contract, you have JT into his 30s on his big contract, then you have to be really careful with the next contract you hand out. Can you now go and sign another forward, a winger potentially, into his 30s to play with Pettersson? And this goes back to something Rutherford himself mentioned, that you can maybe have a couple contracts for players into their 30s long term. You can live with it. But you can't have too many of them. Well, if you have one more in your back pocket to give out, is Lindholm the guy you want to give it to? Like, I'm not sure on that. I'd rather solve your issue with Pettersson long term in terms of having that scoring winger than overspending another guy who's going to, you know, we'll play a lot of minutes for you, but I just don't know what's going to make the overall impact on your roster the way you want long term. You can find that scoring winger. And again, he's a right-handed centerman. It doesn't solve your power play issue. Like, I want to see them find somebody that can solve their top six issue and also solve that issue on the power play and bumper spot. Like, that to me should be the top priority. If I'm spending $7+ million, $9 million, that's what I'm spending it on.
Yeah, especially since already last year, Jansen and I made this point on the show yesterday, like, they traded a really good center in Bo Horvat for a defenseman because they didn't want to be spending that much money down the middle, right? And so it would feel odd to then turn around and commit that money to Elias Lindholm instead. All right, so we've talked so much about the Canucks' own UFAs and who they'll be able to retain, but they're going to have a lot of cap space this year. Is there a player, whether it's someone you're hearing the organization might be interested in, or just somebody that you think would be a really interesting fit, a non-Canucks UFA that you're keeping an eye on as we get closer to July 1st here?
So it kind of broke up. You were asking which UFAs?
Yeah, like, not their UFAs, but like, because we're so focused on the Canucks UFAs, but other guys. Is there anyone who's kind of, you know, top of list for you or top of mind for you, whether it's because the team might be interested or just you think it would be a great fit for them? Other than Jake Guentzel, who's obviously number one.
Right. Well, one guy I kind of, that's the obvious guy. One guy I kind of wonder about, and this is where there are enough intriguing options on the wing too for you to take some lower budget shots at it as well. Like, if you can't find your big, you know, your big long term, I do think there are a few sources you can see to maybe bridge that gap for a year or two. And one guy that I actually am intrigued by is Jason Zucker. And I think he's a guy that has been on their radar in the past. And he wouldn't be first or second on my choice, but he's a left-handed winger. He can play in your top six. He's decent speed. He forechecks well, shoots the puck decently. I can envision him perhaps playing in the bumper spot if you need, right? I can envision him playing with Pettersson. If it doesn't work with him, well, he's an upgrade on Pew Suter, I think, playing alongside JT Miller and Brock Besser. That's a guy that if you get for a 1 or 2 year deal under $5 million, I think, depending on the fit, could really work out. And I know the Canucks, you know, the tires around him last year in free agency, they weren't able to make it happen. They looked at him at the trade deadline. And for a guy who's not going to get paid as much as some of the other higher end wingers, that's a guy that I kind of keep an eye on. That if you're looking to be budget conscious, if you can't find your answers long term, obviously Toffoli will be a nice fit. You know, Gensel will be a nice fit. But I wonder, based on the specific need that they have in the bumper spot, a guy that can get retrievals and can forecheck, a left-handed shot, can play in your top six, I think Jason Zucker would be a decent low-cost bet for a 1 or 2 year deal.
Sat, always appreciate it, man. Thanks for doing this. I love having you on the show. I always feel slightly bad about making you do extra work. So we appreciate the time, man.
Hey, man, anytime. Always fun chatting with you guys. Hey, Garfunkel.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll let you go back to your Simon and Garfunkel listening routine. Thanks, Sat.
All right.
That is Satyar Shah from Canucks Central, coming up in just a couple hours here on Sportsnet 650, joining us and weighing in. And yeah, I mean, Jason Zucker, interesting, as Sat said, right? We've heard his name in connection. Obviously, he was in Pittsburgh as well with this management group. I do wonder what kind of the plan B, right? We talk so much about at that state, but there's every reality if they make Gensel, or if Jake Gensel doesn't make it to the open market in the first place. And what does that kind of plan B look like in terms of trying to just maybe with more volume add that value up front to your roster with guys like Zucker and other deals?
Yeah, look, it's, you know, I really liked Zucker's game in that first round series. I have a lot of time for the player. You know, I do think, I don't know, I don't think that's the sort of move that moves the needle sufficiently. I really think it, this club needs to be aiming a little bit higher, just sort of my reaction to it, which is like, you know, with Zucker's age and how well-traveled he is, you know, he does bring you a weapon you need, but I'd rather find a guy who's, you know, produced but maybe not had the same level of opportunity. Like for me, if you're looking at Zucker, unless the value in terms of term and money is like really, really reasonable,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think you're better off spending the premium and chasing like a Chandler Stephenson, who's been like a 5-on-5 scoring ace, but hasn't sort of factored in on a PP one, right? Like, can he give you 20 more points, right? Can he be a 75-80 point guy, even though he's 30? Not because he's hitting another level, but because you're able to offer him a different opportunity, right? Like that to me would be, I just think the Canucks need to be in a higher end. You know, I really felt like it was so clear once they were matching up game after game against Dreisaitl, McDavid and company that like, it's not enough to just get a top six forward, which is really code for second liner. Like, I think you need to aim higher than that.
There's only so many options, though, on the free agency market, right? And so eventually you got to turn to plan B. Now, Zucker might be more like a plan C type of thing, right? After like the middle level guys like you're talking about, Stevenson. But I do wonder if we what kind of version of that we see if they're not able to add the Gensel or the big trade target at some point this summer. But we will see if they are, in fact, able to do that. That does it for us today. Adrancer's off tomorrow. I will be live at the Nat for a nooner. Show starts at 11. 11 to 1 we're on tomorrow. I don't know if we're going to do Canucks talk the whole time because, look, we're at the Nat. That's always kind of weird. So I think it'll be me and Bick. We'll do some Canucks talk. We'll mix in some general stuff as well, I think. And, yeah, we'll be on the air tomorrow at 11 right here on
Canucks talk at the Nat.
That's right. Right here on Sportsnet 650.